Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a really packed show. I know I say that a lot, but it's really packed, so I'm not even going to go on a whole lot. At the end of the show, we'll be talking with Deborah Sweet, national organizer for World Can't Wait, and we'll be talking about what's going on in Charlotte, North Carolina, and in this election season, and the question of voting for the lesser evil, including Deborah will be announcing and getting into a new program. For all of you people addicted to the Obamalade, she's got a new program, a 12-step program that World Can't Wait developed to overcome the addiction to the Obamalade and voting for the lesser of two evils. Before that, we'll be talking with Riley Wagaman, a former editor at Wonkette.com, about his piece, When Obama Whitewashed Rape. And opening the show up, I'm really pleased. I think it's really important that we open the show up with this particular segment. And this is a segment on rape, okay? This is a segment that is on something that is endemic and just saturates this entire society, the world around, and especially here in the heart of U.S. imperialism. Towards the end of August, Representative Todd Akin made a comment that sort of shook anybody that was a sentient, caring human being. And that comment was basically around rape. And he was indicating that there was such a thing as legitimate rape and illegitimate rape. At the root of all of this was something that came up very, very heavy. And it was something. It was basically part of the war on women that this system, this society, is constantly waging and has been increasingly waging it over the last number of over the last decade or more. Just right after that, I was reading something on the Stop Pornography and Patriarchy website, and I was reading a letter, or I was reading an article that was from our first guest, Andrea Strong, and the title of that article is "Rape is Never the Victim's Fault." And I wanted to have Andrea on the show. I'm really glad we're going to have her on the show in the first part of the show. But I also wanted you to hear the letter that was submitted to the Stop Porn and Patriarchy site by a woman who had been raped as a teenager. And Andrea read this article and was moved to respond to it in what I think you'll agree when we get to talk to her is a very, very powerful response. And I looked around for somebody to read the letter so that we could actually get the full power of it. And I'm really happy to welcome to the show my old friend, who's been with me from the very beginning, times that I started to show up, actually. Christine Blasdale, who is the senior producer at KPFK in Los Angeles. And she's going to join us to read this letter from Abigail Lynn. And the letter's titled, 42 Years Later, I Still Don't Call It Rape, and the Weight of It Gets Heavier All the Time. Christine, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. And I'm actually very honored to be reading this. It's very important. So I'm very pleased to be bringing this to your listeners. I was 42 before it really seriously dawned on me that my first sexual experience was an assault. Even now, in my late 50s, I cannot say it was rape. Rape is what happens to others. This wasn't as bad. Even as I write about it now, I have to soften it, distinguish it from real pain by calling it an assault. It was 1970. I had just turned 15. Much of my life seemed out of control. Parents, peer pressure, poverty, etc. But it was all better when I was babysitting. I had my regular job every day after school and usually Friday and Saturday nights. They were a great hippie couple, both 31, with four wonderful boys. She was beautiful, earthy, smart, and funny. He had long dark hair pulled into a ponytail, stoner blue eyes, and wore tie-dyed t-shirts and love beads. They knew all the local bands, went to all the trippy parties, and stayed out all night long. They introduced me to Janis Joplin, Allen Ginsberg, and weed. She worked all day at an office to pay the bills. He flaked from job to job without much real success. He graduated from seminary school and was a minister for a few years. That is how I met them. He worked at a neighborhood church running all kinds of cool programs for kids. By the time I babysat for them, he was already into a different line of non-work. I wanted to grow up and be in that same kind of situation. I could imagine myself as that mom with some great hippie guy. He was good-looking. I had a crush on him, and I wanted to be like his wife, so I brought it on myself. For years, I blamed myself for what happened. He called me up and asked me to babysit. It was a Wednesday night, so it was a little strange, but I said yes. I got to the house, but he was the only one there. Even the kids were gone. He said he was working on a surprise for his wife and wanted my help. We needed to go into the bedroom. Somehow it involved her closet or her stuff in that room. The rest happened pretty fast. He didn't use real force or bully me. Maybe I was a little flattered, but then I was scared and way, way out of my league. But I tried to be cool and seem in control. I didn't want him to think I was scared. I don't remember much about the next 5 minutes. All that lying and betrayal took a whole 5 minutes. But I remember what happened next. He looked at the sheets and was disappointed that there wasn't more blood. He even commented on it. Again, I wanted to be cool, so I said I wasn't a virgin. I did it all the time. I was just having my period. He said I was the 7th virgin he'd taken to bed since his marriage. But now he was disappointed in me. I wasn't really a virgin. I don't remember how it all became public. Somehow, she found out. My parents found out. Maybe they would call the police. There were phone calls and threats made. My parents, who could barely help themselves, did try to help me. They tried to hold him accountable legally, as if that was going to reassure and comfort me. They were hurt, and I hated to see them hurt. I made that happen. I made them hurt, and I couldn't stand the pain I caused them. I hurt that woman. She never let me back in her house. I lost her. I lost her boys. I hurt everybody. And I couldn't stand to see the damage I had done and the pain in everyone's eyes. I broke everybody and made everything bad. Over the years, I aged but didn't really grow up. I found myself a hippie guy and had kids of my own. I screwed up so many things and damaged and hurt so many people along the way. But that is the material for a different essay. If I ever thought about being 15 and losing my virginity, it was always in the context of, quote, serves you right, and you brought it on yourself. When I was 42, I was driving through town with my best friend. I said, "You're not going to believe what happened this week." I took my kids to the library. What a shock. I saw that hippie mom working the counter. Even though I had moved 100 miles away and over 20 years had passed, there we were again. They had moved to my town, and she worked at my library. I broke into a cold sweat when we were checking out books, but she didn't recognize me. She was nice, pleasant even. As we drove around town, I told my friend about my experience at age 15. I told her that I could never take my kids back to that library. I found out where in town they lived, and I could never go to that part of town. I was still embarrassed and guilty and shameful. Somehow they had managed to stay together, and they had moved to my town. It was now my job to stay out of their way and never make them remember the pain I had caused. There is a reason that we have best friends. They tell us stuff we're supposed to know about ourselves, but don't. She got mad for me. She felt the pain for me that I could never feel. She felt the rage for me that I could never express. In the next 5 minutes, she showed me a different way to interpret those 5 minutes so many years earlier. It never, ever dawned on me that I was only 15 and he was 31. It never occurred to me that I was a child, that I didn't know everything. I wasn't really cool. I didn't ask for it. It did hurt. I was lost. I did run away from home. I didn't want anyone else to hurt, but I never let myself hurt. It never dawned on me that it wasn't just all my fault. I know it in my head now, but I still don't really feel it. I still qualify it. I know women who have had it so much worse. My story is nothing. I didn't suffer as much as others, so it isn't really the same. I don't take on all the blame anymore, but I still can't let it go. I recently found some pictures of that hippie minister from back in the day. I found a few of another neighbor man for whom I babysat. He tried the same thing, but I was wiser that time. I found a few other pictures of old family friends who tried the same kind of thing, but I was better at fighting off old men. Where are these men now? How many lives have they damaged? How did they ever think it was acceptable? What kind of father looks for ways to stain his sheets with the blood of young girls? What kind of sons did he raise? Where are those men today? Where are their daughters? Did they ever learn anything different? Now I'm almost 60. I tell the story and share my aha moment from my past, my best friend's outrage, and my realization. But I still don't feel it. I mostly still feel the guilt and shame. I will burn the pictures of those men because they don't deserve any more recognition in my life. I can cry the tears. I can say that the good in my life outweighs the bad. And I can say that I have now processed the experiences. But it doesn't really change anything. I still don't know what to do with the anger. And the weight of it just gets heavier all the time.
Christine Blasdale, senior producer at KPFK in Los Angeles. Christine, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Christine was reading a story entitled 42 Years Later, I Still Don't Call It Rape, and the Weight of It Gets Heavier All the Time. It's by Abigail Lynn, and it was published as part of Stories from the War Zone, collected by End Pornography and Patriarchy, the Enslavement and Degradation of Women. And joining us now to talk about this and to talk about an article that she wrote on the subject inspired off of this story is Andrea Strong. Andrea, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure. I'm sitting here and, you know, it's very hard to contain yourself, and I feel like I should give the audience a minute to catch their breath. But I want to jump right into this. You had a very, very deep, visceral, and really deep response to this story, and that led you to write your piece. Can you talk about that a little?
Absolutely. So I wrote this piece, Rape is Never the Victim's Fault. And, you know, it came out of going to New York City for a 10-day initiative to take patriarchy by storm and fighting with a group of people, actually going to different sites of women's oppression. I had sort of my own aha moment when we were in Hooters that, you know, like I have those voices in my head too, those voices of self-blame, and I didn't experience anything on the level of being raped, but just the culture that we live in, I think, really sets the stage for women taking those traumatic experiences and blaming themselves. So sort of like out of this, like taking patriarchy by storm and going and fighting in this way, like I began to see for the first time that it wasn't actually my fault. And so when she wrote her piece, when I read that, it did strike a very deep chord within me. And it's women should not be blamed for the crimes that are done to them. So the first part of this piece is rape is never the victim's fault. And then I repeat that and say also, if you were raped, suspect you were raped, or if you were coerced by words or charm or threat and may not call it rape, but still feel violated, it was not your fault.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Andrea Strong, who's the author of the article, Rape is Never the Victim's Fault. And Andrea is a member of End Pornography and Patriarchy, the Enslavement and Degradation of Women. You know, it's very heavy because I was thinking about this the other night. I was watching just a series of, you know, bad movies that you kind of watch in the middle of the night to try and get back to sleep. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were all these, you know, in one form or another, drunken guys going out and hitting on women. And it's all supposed to be laugh and fun and play. And in every one of those films, it came down to, she may be saying no, but actually her eyes are saying yes. And actually she's really, she really wants it. And this is the way you can tell that she wants it. And I kept thinking about your piece. I kept thinking about the letter and I kept thinking about your piece. And there's a point you make in here where you say we live in a rape culture and it has very little to do with sex. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of what fuels rape culture is porn culture. I've been thinking about that quite a bit lately. And I mean, there's, you go into a porn store and you see, like, you don't actually ever see the word woman on any of those titles or descriptions. And then furthermore, a lot of the plot lines, what little plot there actually is to those films, is about how women are at first saying no, but then they get to a point where they actually like what's being done to them. And really what pornography does is it takes something that should be a shared experience between people and turns it into degradation and domination. And I think that's where a lot of the ideas that people have about what sex is come from. Rape is actually, it's a form of controlling somebody else, whether that's through physical violence, or if it's emotional pressure or leveraging of power or some other social capital, to the point where the victim of the rape feels anything from humiliation all the way up to fear for their life as the dominant emotions. And I also think any female, anywhere, doing any kind of activity at their job, at their school, wearing any kind of clothing is at risk for being raped, and is also at risk for then being blamed for her rape.
Yeah, you know, and the thing is it comes out a lot of times. If it's not the thing of the sort of supposedly funny, you know, yeah, well, here's the secret. She really means yes. Actually, you make the point, and you speak very movingly to this, that so many times women are told, whether it's just insinuated in like in the story from Abigail Lynn, or whether it's just put straight out, like in so many times when men have raped women and they say, well, she asked for it. She came to my room dressed in scanty clothes or a tight skirt. She asked for it. What's she doing walking down the street with really short shorts on? What's the matter with her? She's asking for it. Don't you see that? And that's a very accepted argument for she wasn't raped. She was asking
right.
for it.
Yeah.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about is this thing of you talk about a point that's made in relation to that, what I was just mentioning about you asked for it, you know, women asked for it.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about these lists that are put out that tell women how to avoid being raped. And I'd like you to speak about that because I think a lot of times people think, well, this is the way to handle this. But you actually make a point around those lists. And you also say that one of the things it does is it makes it seem like rape is just natural and part of our natural environment.
Right. Yeah. And I used a little bit of humor. I mean, there's sort of a line in there toying with like, you know, here's Vanna with the forecast. And she says, well, Todd, it appears there's a big rape cloud threatening the area around Main Street. So if you own a vagina, you're going to want to lock your car doors, or better yet, just not go anywhere tonight if you don't have to. So I think that using humor to get at this thing that, you know, if you can't avoid rape, if you're a woman and you've been raped and you didn't use those lists or whatever, it was your fault. Rape is not a natural hazard. It's not a natural or permanent part of our landscape. It's a conscious act that's done by somebody to somebody else. So I think the list should be rewritten. And actually, there's a list online. I believe it was put out by Slutwalk. And it basically says, don't assault people. One of my favorites on the list talks about, consider telling somebody if you plan to rape them. Don't blame them if they didn't think that you intended to rape them.
We're talking with Andrea Strong, who is the author of the article, Rape is Never the Victim's Fault. And she's a member of the End Pornography and Patriarchy, the Enslavement and Degradation of Women Initiative. You know, and the horrifying aspect of that, too, comes down to something else you point out in your piece, where you're talking about look around you when you're in public. Look around you when you're in any room full of people. Look around you when you're around a lot of women and realize that, and these are the statistics that you run out in your piece, which are really stunning no matter how many times you hear them, that one out of every four women that you see has been raped.
Yeah.
25% of women have been raped. And in the U.S., every 2 minutes a woman is raped. Think about that. What is that adding up to? And then that 80% of women that are raped by somebody they know that they probably trust and maybe the woman even likes and admires, which is really this point about the betrayal, the most intense betrayal by people who are your most intimate friends and lovers. You know, you think about this, people that you know that are in your daily life that then do this and how many women that impacts. It's an incredible statistics and one that should really make people think very, very hard about what the hell is going on in this society.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I mean, and there are some people, I read some comments online because one of the things I was looking at was Daniel Tosh made this joke, this rape joke. And there was a woman in the audience who stood up and said, rape jokes are never funny. And he said, well, wouldn't it be funny if, you know, four or five guys raped that woman right now? Yeah, that is not funny. And actually, she was standing up and asserting something. Like, I think a lot of people don't really realize how many walking wounded there are, how many people are walking around with the shame of sexual assault and rape. And there's no place for them to have that anger and that pain be understood or to be unleashed in any meaningful way. I make the point later on in this piece that if you get into this movement to stop the war on women, something profound can really be unleashed. And we've seen it every single time that we've gone out and talked to people. We just had a fundraiser for End Pornography and Patriarchy here in Seattle. And people wrote down these stories that are just really, they're really incredible. You don't have to go very far to hear these stories from people. All people need is a little bit of an invitation and us putting out that this is not okay, this is unacceptable, this has to stop. And you just hear these incredible stories. I mean, Abigail is definitely not the only one that's out there.
We're talking with Andrea Strong, who's the author of the piece, Rape is Never a Victim's Fault. Let me read you something. We're going to move to wrap this up, but I wanted to read you something from the book Basics, Bob Avakian's book Basics. Mm-hmm. And it's a quote that I wanted you to hear and then ask your reaction to it, well, your thoughts on it in relation to everything we've been talking about. You cannot break all the chains except one. You cannot say you want to be free of exploitation and oppression except you want to keep the oppression of women by men. You can't say you want to liberate humanity, yet keep one half of the people enslaved to the other half. The oppression of women is completely bound up with the division of society into masters and slaves, exploiters and exploited, and the ending of all such conditions is impossible without the complete liberation of women. All this is why women have a tremendous role to play, not only in making revolution, but in making sure there is all the way revolution. The fury of women can and must be fully unleashed as a mighty force for proletarian revolution.
I love that quote. Absolutely love that quote. I took part in this initiative, and I'm part of this movement to end pornography and stop patriarchy as a revolutionary communist. And, you know, I do think that there is an end to patriarchy, that the relations between men and women that exist now, this is not an example of human nature. This is not boys being boys. This is a certain kind of society, a class-divided society, and it doesn't have to continue to be this way. And also what the quote gets into that I really like about it is that you have to get rid of all the chains. All of our liberation is bound up with each other. Black people can't be free if women aren't free. Actually, I was talking with a friend the other day, and she made this point that I thought was really pertinent, that looking at women's oppression in and of itself, if you're just about, you know, fighting for women to have the right to abortion and birth control, and you're not actually looking into all these other chains that exist for women, rape and sexual assault, and then pornography and what kind of culture that creates, we have to break all of those chains of women's oppression as well. All of that stuff is all bound up together, and we can actually get to a point where humanity doesn't have to live this way.
All right, Andrea, we're going to have to wrap it up on that note. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks a lot.
Okay, take care now.
Bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Andrea Strong about her piece, Rape is Never the Victim's Fault. And you can find that piece at the End Pornography and Patriarchy site, their Tumblr site. You can find that piece, their website. You can find that piece and a lot of other stories collected about the suffering that women undergo, the assault that women undergo in a society that is built on and contains a culture of rape and oppression and enslavement of women. We're going to take a quick break and come right back to talk with Riley Wagaman about how this plays out with Obama's response to rape and what he's actually saying and doing in relation to that. So stay tuned. Welcome back. And that was Rape, Tactic of War from Fundamental and the album Peace, Not War, Disc 2. And that was a very appropriate song to lead into this next segment, which is we'll be talking with Riley Wagaman, a former editor at Wonkette.com and the author of the article When Obama Whitewashed Rape. Riley, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
Well, where to begin? You know, in late August, I was thinking about Representative Todd Akin's asinine remarks trying to distinguish somehow between supposed legitimate rape and illegitimate rape, a comment that is, yeah, you're tempted to kind of think like, well, to dismiss it because it's just asinine and stupid, but actually it's a comment that carries with it a tremendous potential for great harm, especially living in a society like the one we live in, where we live in a culture of rape and where many, 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 many women, including many that we know of all ages, have been raped or will be raped in their lifetime. This kind of comment, this kind of outlook, this kind of discussion of legitimate and illegitimate rape can cause a tremendous amount of harm. And then Obama, Barack Obama, in his snake oil kind of way, got up and made some comment about rape is rape. And he called Akin's comments as being way out there, and he defined rape and he said it doesn't make sense to the American people and doesn't make sense to me. Well, what attracted to me to Riley Wagaman's piece was the title of it, which is When Obama Whitewashed Rape. What drove you to write this piece, man? What were you thinking? It's great you're telling the truth about this. What were you thinking?
Well, I'll be really honest. You know, I left Wonkette very disillusioned with American politics. I mean, I'm a young writer. I just turned 25. And I left the country physically because I was so fed up with the political situation. You know, I really just became, I had no faith in either party. And what I saw, you know, in the last few weeks are all of these posts on Facebook, you know, from all my old college buddies and just sort of people I know in very sort of ambiguous ways, you know, calling Barack Obama this feminist and how he sort of, you know, put Todd Akin in his place. And that really got me angry. And I haven't done any formal political writing in more than a year, but I felt this obligation to just sort of say, well, you know, you say that Barack Obama is this brave feminist, but look at his actual record when it comes to rape, and it tells a very different story.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because what you zeroed in on, too, in terms of his record on rape was the whole idea of the rape in connection to war, a war tactic in connection to the U.S. military and its occupation and pillaging of countries around the world. Can we talk about that a little? Because this is something that really, I think, doesn't really strike people. It's something that actually gets hidden. And you brought something out that I think people don't really know that much about, that Barack Obama actually was not so opposed to rape when it came to raping prisoners and people in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right. Well, I mean, I want to just be very clear. You know, I don't think that Barack Obama likes rape, but I think that it's very clear that when it's politically expedient, he'll say, rape is rape. What's wrong with these evil Republicans? And then when it comes to light that the U.S. military committed obscene rapes and sexual assaults that were meticulously documented, he will whitewash it and sweep it under the table. And that really doesn't put a lot of confidence. I mean, I don't even consider this a women's issue. Anyone who is, you know, has some humanity in them should be really disturbed by this fact.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, who knows what the hell Obama thinks, but I certainly don't think that the question is whether or not someone says, you know, I really like rape. I mean, there are savages
right.
in the world that do that. And frankly, in a society, though, where you're the commander in chief, you're the head, you're the leader of this society that, in fact, is a culture of rape. Rape and pornography and patriarchy and all the things that really literally keep so many women in chains in this society. And I was just with my guest before you, we were just talking about the immense numbers in terms of the women that are raped. 25% of the women that you see around you are raped. One woman every
right.
2 minutes is raped in America.
The number's even higher in the military, if I'm mm-hmm. not mistaken.
It's yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Statistic.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Actually, I saw Invisible War a few months back. And, you know, when they talk about that, and that you know, just scraped the surface in terms of the conditions that women are facing in the military, it was a very heavy thing. And it relates to that point about rape is often a tactic of the U.S. Rape and the degradation of women's bodies is often a tactic and part of their strategic concept in terms of the pillaging of these countries, whether it's, you know, the Philippines way back 100 years ago, the, you know, the Vietnam, all of these places where they just the savaging of women and the rape being actually a tactic of war. You think about that, and that adds another whole other dimension to Obama's statement about all this and what he did and in relation to the rape that actually he had a part in covering up, which we should talk about a little because I don't think people really know what we're talking about yet.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, and that's exactly sort of the point. You know, when you bring this up, people literally don't know that Major General Antonio Tacuba, who was charged with investigating Abu Ghraib and also cases of rape and sexual assault in a half dozen other prisons around Iraq and Afghanistan, he was very clear that, you know, these photographs that are available show torture, abuse, rape, and every indecency. And that's a direct quote from him. And it's amazing that the Obama administration went to great lengths to discrediting this statement and also every instance where the press tried to bring it to light and what that means, you know, in relation to Obama's statement in response to Todd Akin, which is, you know, rape is rape. There's no room for, you know, any sort of, it's not ambiguous, you know, rape is rape. But, it, you know, unless it's an Iraqi female detainee, then, you know, rape never happened.
We're talking with Riley Wagaman, former editor at Wonkette.com and author of the article When Obama Whitewashed Rape.
Well, you know, one of the things, too, is, I mean, just to show you how serious this is, you point out that actually Obama defied a court order to actually release the photos of these incidents of rape in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Actually, it's interesting. He lost the court hearing, and he decided, okay, we're gonna agree to this. We're going to release these photos. It was the ACLU, you know, filing. And what was supposed to be released was 44 photographs along with a substantial number of other images contained in Army Criminal Investigation Division reports. And in these reports, it was thought that up to 2,000 photographs were present within these reports. And so the story goes, Obama was shown what he's releasing, and then he suddenly changes his mind. But this is what's really interesting, is that while Major General Taguba says, we shouldn't release these photos because they're so hideous and they show rape and all sorts of indecencies, and the mere description of these pictures is horrendous enough. Take my word for it. That's a direct quote. Obama says, I want to emphasize that these photos that were requested in this case are not particularly sensational. It shows this sort of complete lack of, I mean, I don't even know, you know, as just a basic human being, you'd expect the president, fine, don't release the photos. I completely disagree with that decision, but at least acknowledge what it shows. And it's really disheartening.
But what the hell does that mean, Riley? What does that mean that they're not sensational?
Yeah, well, it's a really good question. And just to be perfectly honest, just to give your listeners, you know, I don't want to pull any fast ones on them. The full quote is, I want to emphasize that these photos that were requested in this case are not particularly sensational, especially when compared to the painful images that were remembered from Abu Ghraib. Now, let's be very clear. Many of the photos released publicly available are very hideous. Some of them are, you know, it's a photo of a dog barking at a detainee curled up in a corner. And I have a hard time believing that that is as so-called sensational or painful as a photo of a uniformed U.S. soldier sodomizing a female detainee, which is what General Taguba says these photos show. I mean, the descriptions that Taguba disclosed to the Daily Telegraph are very painful to even read.
You know, it also raises a question here when you're thinking about this. And here's Obama has clearly seen the photos. He's decided they're not sensational. And yet, at the same time, the military, the U.S. military, turns around and its comments on this is actually, what photos? They don't exist. There's no photos. What are you talking about?
Right. Well, actually, it's funny you bring that up. In fact, so the Pentagon came out after this report was made by the Daily Telegraph, and they said they got the facts wrong and that none of the photos that were requested by this ACLU lawsuit shows or depicts rape or sexual assault. At the same time, actually, and I just found this video the other day on C-SPAN, Robert Gibbs, it was during a White House press briefing, and he said, this is incredible, and I'm not even making this up, Robert Gibbs comes to, you know, the podium and says, maybe the British press should spend more time reporting on Manchester United, you know, soccer games than reporting about torture, because they obviously don't know what they're talking about.
Wow. Wow.
And he says that it's a complete mischaracterization of what the photos show, and it's shameless. It really is.
Let me remind listeners that we're talking with Riley Wagaman, a former editor at Wonkette.com and author of the article When Obama Whitewashed Rape. Has there been any attempt anywhere, I mean, besides what you've written, has there been any attempt of anywhere for anybody to say, look, here's what was said by General Taguba. Well, here's what was said. Here's what we know about the photos. And here's what's said by Obama and about by the military. And if you put these together, something is really rotten here. Has there been any attempt to actually dig into this?
Well, what's interesting is that right after the story came out, Human Rights Watch demanded an investigation into these photos. But, of course, we're never going to see them, so we can't. It's never going to happen. And they demanded an independent investigation. What I think is also important for your listeners to know is that after General Taguba released his investigation on Abu Ghraib, he was forced into retirement because he was unwilling to whitewash what the Obama administration did. It's very telling. You know, it's very telling that you have a senior, very senior U.S. military officer who literally told Seymour Hersh in 2007, and he wrote about this in The New Yorker, that he saw a video of a uniformed member of the U.S. military sodomizing a female detainee. A video. You know, it's unfathomable, and it's horrifying. But the official Obama administration talking point is that none of this exists and none of it ever happened.
And this plays into something we were talking about off the air when you were when I first talked with you. You know, this idea that you speak to it a little in your piece, where various magazines, for instance, are looking at what Obama has said on the, you know, just said the surface of what he said. And they're saying that, you know, he's the new feminist in town. And you send people to these links that are all these ads that are run by, I can't remember the name of the magazine that's running it, but all these ads.
Bust, maybe?
Maybe, yeah, Bust. And then I think there was something else, Nerve, something like that.
Yeah, Nerve.
Yeah. And there were all these things that actually had Obama, you know, in this sort of saintly portrait and really taking a stand against the oppression of women. And yet that's all played out against this terrible stuff that's been going on that you've been describing. And people seem to just have willingly burying their heads deeper and deeper in the sand around this. And it's particularly dangerous today when you're actually when you're talking about people more and more looking for one way or the other. They're going to, you know, and not that I think Romney's any better than Obama. But frankly, we're talking about the fate of the world is in our hands to a large extent, you know, and the more that we actually don't own up to and admit that there are people who are running this country who are committing tremendous crimes, war crimes against people around the world, it's a very dangerous situation for all of humanity. I mean, it just really bugs me around that. And I think, you know, what do you think about this idea of this point about people willingly sticking their heads in the sand around this and many other things?
I mean, it's prevalent and it's unfortunate. And, you know, I'll say to that, you have people reacting to Todd Akin, Representative Todd Akin's statement, and it was very ignorant and, quite frankly, deeply offensive, you know, and obviously not just to women. But at the end of the day, it was a victimless crime. It was just a sort of ignorant old Missouri man speaking hypothetically about rape. And I'm sure that it offended rape victims tremendously, but no one was actually physically harmed by Todd Akin. And in this situation, you have literally hundreds of cases of documented rape and sexual assault that the Obama administration completely whitewashed. You know, they don't even exist, these photographs. They don't even admit that these photographs exist. And how is there no outrage about this? It really makes me, I can't say that I'm really angry about it because I've just sort of given up on being angry, but it's almost sort of humorous in a sick way, you know, that people get so angry about hypotheticals that have no real victims, and then there's literally women and men and young men. If you read the actual detainee, you know, statements, young men, women who are raped by U.S. personnel, and people just ignore it, you know, and Obama ignores it. And how does that work? You know, and really, what I've realized, I worked in Washington, I wrote about politics for a year. You know, people look through, you know, people experience politics through their own prism. And, you know, when the facts are seen through the Obama prism, you know, it bends truth to, you know, into, I don't know, Todd Akin is a meanie and we need to get him. You know, and it doesn't matter what Obama's done. And I've spent enough time around these people to recognize that no matter what the facts are, they're not going to hold Obama to the same standards that they do with the Republicans. And that's not, I'm not, you know, endorsing anything that the Republicans do. I think that they're also awful and have a horrible track record with women. But if you're not going to use those same standards to Obama, what does that say? What does that say about us, you know, as supposed liberals, you know?
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Riley Wagaman, a former editor at Wonkette.com. And author of the article, When Obama Whitewashed Rape. You know, one of the things I'd also say, though, too, and I think we're going to have to move to wrap this up a little bit, but one of the things I was thinking about as you were talking is that there is a link, there is a commonality that's shared between Akin's and what he said, the people that have their heads buried in the sand, and what Obama said and has done, and the U.S. military has said and done. And that is that all of these things, while some of them, they may not be directly going out, at least with Obama and Akin's, they're not directly going out and raping people as far as we know. At the same time, you know, everything that they say, and as much as they downplay the savagery and the importance of actually standing up and fighting against, speaking out and fighting against the assault against women, the war on women, concentrated in many ways by rape, as they're helping to create and foster a culture of rape that continues to, you know, just condition and reinforce that kind of oppression of women in general, and really has a, you know, and I think it's something, as you said earlier, it's not something just for women to think about, it's that, or to stand up against, but it's something for everybody who has a shred of humanity in them to stand up and oppose, you know?
Absolutely. And I just want to add one more thing, too, is that, you know, this report included, it wasn't just Abu Ghraib, it was a half dozen prisons around Iraq and Afghanistan, and from what I understand, it also included Parwan Detention Facility, better known as Bagram Airfield. And under the Obama administration, the number of prisoners in this facility has doubled. And there have been documented cases of prisoners being tortured to death in this facility, and it's still open. You know, it's like the Abu Ghraib that never closed. And we don't really know what's going on now. I mean, there could be ongoing abuses, and we'll never know the full truth because the Obama administration never came clean about the Bush administration, you know, all the things that happened in the Bush administration. They never came clean about the rapes and the sexual assaults. And this horrible institution that was started by the Bush administration is going, it's very healthy under the Obama administration. And so this isn't just something that we can, Obama always talked about we have to just look forward. Well, we can look forward and, you know, Bagram Airfield is still around. You know, nothing has changed. It's just probably gotten worse in a lot of ways.
In fact, I read somewhere recently that they've applied for the permission to expand the airbase there, the prison there, to contain 5,500 more people than who they have in there now. I think they have something like 3,300 people in there now.
Yeah, I mean, the last I heard, they actually doubled the population from the Bush administration, from when the Bush administration was administrating it. But it has a horrible track record, horrible human rights record, and it's still around. And, you know, really, if these photos had gotten out, I really wonder if Obama would have been able to maintain, you know, our presence in Iraq and Afghanistan for so long. And, I mean, in Afghanistan, of course, still going on. I mean, you know, it's sort of like the Vietnam photo of the naked girl running with the napalm. I mean, if there was a photo, a public photo, of a U.S. soldier in uniform raping an Iraqi detainee, I wonder what that would have done to the war effort.
I agree. And I think actually the sum of the thing, too, though, with Vietnam is that actually a lot of us back then didn't have our heads buried in the sand. And what that did was it not only solidified the resistance that existed, but it also, as you're saying, it opened the eyes of a lot of people who were just shocked, you know, to see that happen.
And, well, you know, wars are sold with images and they can be destroyed by images. Mm-hmm. And that's just how the world works.
And
I've worked in journalism long enough to know that you can write the most scathing and factually accurate report about what's going on in the world, and people won't really, you know, they won't take it all in unless they can see it.
All right, Raleigh, we're going to have to wrap it up, and I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, and please send along your radio show when it's all ready to go. I'd love to hear it.
I definitely will, man. And where can people find your work? You're still writing anywhere?
You know, I'm like I said, honestly, this is a one-time thing. I've sort of been in retirement for a year, but I might be submitting more to Counterpunch in the future, but, I mean, just Google my name, I guess.
Okay, Google your name, and you can add the conditioner, retired at 25. What the hell are you doing, man?
Yeah, right, exactly. Retired at 25, now teaching English.
Right. All right, Riley, thanks a lot, man. And keep
right,
up the work
care.
On that on this
Bye.
Exposure, man. Thank you very much. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Riley Wagaman, a former editor at Wonkette.com and the author of When Obama Whitewashed Rape, which appears in the August 30th edition of Counterpunch. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joining Deborah Sweet, the National Director of World Can't Wait, to talk about the current election season, what's going on in Charlotte, and 12 steps to overcome addiction to voting for the lesser evil. So don't miss it. Stay tuned.
To me, you
Okay, welcome back. That was Kool-Aid from Rye Cooter's latest album, Election Special. And I have to tell you, the only reason I'm playing that, people that know the album will understand that the album, or they might know that the album is actually done as an homage to Barack Obama. But when you listen to a song like Kool-Aid that's on this album, you really have to appreciate the irony. Here's Rye Cooter singing praise hymns to Obama, but he's talking about "I drank the Kool-Aid." Perhaps he should wake up and smell the Kool-Aid and see where it's going. Joining us now to talk about all this, to talk about the Democratic National Convention, to talk about this election season and many other things, is Deborah Sweet, Director, National Director of the World Can't Wait organization. And we're going to be talking about what World Can't Wait is doing in relation to the Democratic National Convention and this whole season, and a couple of other surprise things that we'll get into as the interview progresses. Deborah, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Michael.
Sure. Well, what is World Can't Wait doing these days? They're down in Charlotte at the convention, right?
Well, we have a crew there, and we've been there for days protesting outside the convention in the no-go zone. We were actually able to get a 1/5 model Reaper drone replica right into the convention area and get it in front of the delegates, where we were told no protest would possibly be allowed, but we persevered and brought a crew of occupiers and protesters and talked to the Democrats, like delegates that were lining up to go into different events, about the fact that there may be a lesser of two evils and there might not, but we're not going for either evil.
Well, how do you explain that when you talk to people about the lesser of two evils? Because I know that's something that always comes up. Well, which one is worse? Would you rather have Mitt Romney in there? Not, then how about going with Obama? We're always confronted with that kind of a choice. What is World Can't Wait saying about that? How are you dealing with that?
Well, we've gone at it, you know, we're just trying to get people to confront reality, as always. We put out a postcard in Charlotte. What the front of the postcard says, superimposed over a photograph of a 6-year-old child who was injured in a U.S. drone bombing in Pakistan, is, ask this child if the Democrats are really the lesser of two evils. And, of course, that's speaking to the fact that Obama has carried out 8 times more drone bombings and attacks than Bush did, and, in fact, has developed the targeted kill list. And we know for a fact that children and civilians are being killed in at least 4 countries by these drone bombings. And, of course, to them, it doesn't matter whether it's a Democrat or a Republican doing it, and we feel the same way. Both of these parties are, in a sense, worse. They've signed up for the continuation of the global U.S. war on terror, whether Obama calls it something else or not. It's actually expanded and become more effective under the Democrats than it was when the Bush regime was trying to sell it to the world. And that was bad enough. Now we have a situation where so many people have indeed swallowed the Kool-Aid that they're unable to distinguish crimes being carried out by their own government simply because it's the Democrats in power, or, you know, in the particular case of Obama, because the president is African American, he couldn't possibly be carrying out war crimes on people around the rest of the world or doing anything bad to the basic people in this country.
You know, it's interesting, Deborah, because that is one of the things. I had Ted Rawl on my show a couple of weeks ago, and one of the things that we got a lot of complaints off of that show. They were upset that he was actually laying bare all of this stuff that Obama has done. And in the end, he said, look, let's be clear. Obama is a monster. And I mean, this is, you know, my listeners are generally progressive people, and people just went over the top being upset about this kind of definition of Obama. I don't know. I mean, it's really distressing. How do you see things shaping up in a society?
Well, we just have to keep putting it in front of them. People maybe do want to close their eyes. World Can't Wait came out with our program to overcome addiction to voting for the lesser of two evils. And, of course, we're trying to put the idea back in current consumption. I've been hearing this for 40-some years. You're always going to have to vote for the lesser of two evils. I never bought it 40 years ago. I really don't buy it now. But we said things to people like this. Number 4 is stop lying to yourself. The president is not sucking up to the most powerful interests in the world because he loves you. you.
What? Before we get into this, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking now with Deborah Sweet, the National Director of World Can't Wait, and we're talking about the upcoming election season, the Democratic Convention, Obama, the willful blinding of oneself in relation that so many people are undergoing in the course of this election season around Obama and the lesser of two evils. And Deborah and World Can't Wait have put out, World Can't Wait has put out, actually, it's a 12-step program, isn't it, huh?
We adopted it off the program that some people use to deal with addiction because we realized, people are really addicted to thinking. First of all, that the way they can have any effect and agency in this society is to vote for president. And number two, all the vast numbers of people that are the base of the Democratic Party, the millions and millions in this country, are addicted to the idea that a Democrat is always going to be better than a Republican. And no, I will just say this up front. I do not think that Romney would be better than Obama. They're both worse. But we put out this 12-step program, and we got some of the same response you did. First of all, I got the whole spectrum of, this is a brilliant program that you've put out, someone really meaning it, all the way to, oh, yeah, that's really brilliant, Deborah. You're going to put us into the hands of Romney. But I think it really did strike a chord because we were trying to bring out, underlying all this, what's been the dynamic? Obama, and in a sense, Obama is the only one that could have done it in this way. He sold a lot of people on ideas that they never would have accepted from a George Bush. In fact, people didn't accept a George Bush, voted the Republicans resoundingly out of office, brought in Obama only because they thought that was going to bring something massively different. And in fact, this massive hope and change clearly didn't come about. We're just trying to get people to look at, okay, this was promised, this is what happened. And in many cases, people are saying, well, he didn't follow through on his promises. Yes, he did. Number one, he said all along, Afghanistan's a good war, we're going to expand it. 150,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan, 100,000 are still there. They've signed up to occupy Afghanistan until the year 2024. Yeah, nobody talks about this. They're not talking about it at the convention tonight. I guarantee that.
Right. And in fact, when you think about it, what they are talking about, it has nothing to do with the realities of what all these war crimes that Obama has committed and that U.S. imperialism is committing. You know, you think about this. It is really true, though, that's this point of, you know, people, did Obama lie to people or did people really lie to themselves? And that's something that I think we have to really grapple with. And you come to it's step number 10. And by the way, when you start opening up these meeting places, I want you to invite me to some of these meeting places so we can go down and record some of these people overcoming their addiction to voting for the lesser of two evils. You make in number 10, you say, come to grips with this. The only thing scarier than a Republican Party, a party full of climate change deniers, fundamentalist woman haters, and gay bashers, election stealers, and racists, is a party who continually moves to the right to accommodate them and gets Americans to go along in that direction. That's a pretty important step in these 12 steps, I'd say.
I'd say so, too. This is what people have been enfolded into, signing up for things that they never thought they would sign up for. You have some of the leading progressive Democratic thinkers who were critics of the Bush administration now literally selling the targeted killing program under Obama. And it's okay because Obama's making the list. Well, even if you buy that, which I don't, what if Romney's making the list? What if Obama and the whole Democratic-Republican establishment has fought this hard to give the executive power, whoever the executive is, to make that list, to detain people under the NDAA, as they now have the ability to do, without charges, whether they're citizens or not? What if you're putting all your support to that on the basis of a Democrat running it, and it's this bad? Then what if a Republican gets in there and does it? You already own it. It's the same situation as Nancy Pelosi and the senator from California, Dianne Feinstein, being in the council at the beginning of the Bush regime, when torture was discussed and they signed off on Guantanamo, they knew about Abu Ghraib. They signed off on the torture memo. This is all part of two ruling class parties colluding in how power is going to be maintained in this country.
All right, Deborah, and can you give people an address where they can find out, follow what World Can't Wait is doing through this whole time period now?
WorldCan'tWait.net. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter.
All right, Deborah, thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll keep you coming back so we can follow this up and explore all these different avenues and keep up on top of the how that 12-step program is developing, all right?
Okay, thanks, Michael.
All right, thanks, Deborah. Talk to you later. Mm-hmm. Bye now.
Bye.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Deborah Sweet, the National Director of World Can't Wait. And we've been talking about, actually, a lot of the conversation has been about the willful blinding that a lot of people have been doing to themselves when it comes to Obama and the lesser of two evils question, and in particular about World Can't Wait's development of a 12-step program for recovering addicts, 12 steps to overcome addiction to voting for the lesser of two evils. And, all right, well, that just about brings our program to a close this week. I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank Christine Blasdale, senior producer at KPFK, for reading the letter, 42 Years Later, I Still Don't Call It Rape, and the Weight of It Gets Heavier All the Time, that we open the show up with. I also want to thank Andrea Strong, who wrote a response off of that letter called Rape is Never a Woman's Fault. And I want to thank Riley Wagaman for his article, When Obama Whitewashed Rape. And I want to thank Deborah Sweet, who we've just been talking with. And I want to thank my production assistant, Henry Carson, my board op, Teddy Robinson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with something from Ministry, and I rarely play things from Ministry, but I really like them, and this piece is called Land of Rape and Honey, so check it out.